Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Andrew Coburn, Washington editor with Harper's Magazine, who discusses damning assessments of the U.S. military's drone warfare program revealed in recently published secret documents. Mary Grant of Food and Water Watch, who talks about her group's campaign to stop the privatization of water resources across the U.S., while promoting affordability and water quality. And Jack Cushman, a reporter with Inside Climate News, who summarizes his publication's groundbreaking investigative report on what Exxon knew about climate change and its decision to promote disinformation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
With the renewal of U.S.-Cuban relations and improved economic ties, a new housing boom is underway in Havana. Handmade for sale signs hang outside many old colonial homes as new condo complexes are under construction in sight of decaying older buildings. For now, the U.S. embargo makes it illegal for Americans to buy real estate in Cuba, but prices are rising in anticipation of a massive future spike in housing values and plenty of under-the-table sales to foreigners. While a modest $55,000 house may be a steal in South Florida, it is still out of reach for most Cubans. Speculation has already taken hold with million-dollar listings for a four-bedroom penthouse in Havana. Sandra Arias, a foreign language professor, has gone into the real estate business seeking out foreign buyers, mostly Canadians, the French, and Russians. The thawing of U.S.-Cuban relations has generated excitement among realtors and new opportunities for families who often live in cramped living conditions. An enormous coal-fired power plant carved out of a virgin forest sits 300 miles south of New Delhi. It's a sign of India's economic ambitions to catch up with Chinese industrialization requiring cheap electricity. The Sasan power plant, with financing from the U.S. Export-Import Bank, has triggered various land disputes and displaced villagers who are facing new economic hardship. According to the Los Angeles Times, India wants to bring electricity to 300 million people by exploiting locally available coal supplies. By boosting its use of dirty coal, the Indian government is ignoring global demands to reduce the nation's greenhouse emissions. In a village near the Sasan plant, a mountain of mining waste now surrounds brick and mud huts. In 2014, India's Ministry of Environment and Forests ruled the plant's mining waste was illegally being dumped in forests, and the project's developer, Reliance Power, failed to restore lost green space. Reliance Power promised benefits to local communities, including cheap electricity, new housing, and schools. Yet most of these promises have been broken. Farmer Ramji Besor lives next to the Sasan plant, where coal dust now covers his crops and has gotten into his irrigation water supply. He was offered $26,000 to leave his land, but rejected it since the money didn't cover the cost of buying a new farm as land prices soared while the power plant was being built. On October 13th, the 3rd District Court of Appeals reinstated a federal lawsuit by Muslim residents of New Jersey against the New York City Police Department for broad surveillance of Muslim communities, including mosques and businesses. An investigation by the Associated Press uncovered a decade-long surveillance program run by the NYPD against Muslim communities in New York and New Jersey. The squad in charge of the sweeps, known as the Demographics Unit, was disbanded by New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio in 2014. The appeals court ruling overturned a decision by Federal District Court Judge William Martini, who dismissed the case, claiming that the Muslim plaintiffs hadn't suffered any harm. In contrast, the appeals court compared the NYPD intelligence gathering operation to the Red Scare of the 1940s and 50s. Judge Thomas Ambrose wrote, "We have been down this road before. Jewish Americans during the Red Scare, African Americans during the Civil Rights Movement, and Japanese Americans during World War II. Bahar Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, declared, "This case of religious profiling is the other side of the stop-and-frisk coin. There is no Muslim exception to the Constitution." Glenn Caton, legal director of Muslim Advocates, which was a co-counsel in the case, said the group looked forward to pursuing the lawsuit to ensure that no American should be spied on simply because of the way he or she prays. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
An anonymous whistleblower working within a U.S. intelligence agency recently leaked secret documents to the online investigative publication The Intercept. The documents provide an uncensored view of the U.S. drone warfare program's operations in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia between 2011 and 2013. The source of the documents said they provided this information to the press because they believe the public has a right to understand the process by which people are placed on kill lists and ultimately assassinated on orders from the highest echelons of the U.S. government. The Intercept's 8-part series of articles, titled The Drone Papers, reveals the flaws in the Pentagon's 14-year air campaign conducted against suspected terrorists that has used unreliable information to make life-and-death decisions in the assassination program. The unknown number of civilians killed in these operations has served to outrage entire communities and has been used as a recruiting tool by anti-Western and terrorist groups. The authors of the Intercept series expressed hope that their investigation will provoke a public debate on the legal and moral consequences of a secret assassination program with little or no oversight or checks and balances. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Coburn, Washington editor with Harper's Magazine, and author of a new book on the U.S. drone program titled Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Here, Coburn discusses the value of these documents in assessing the deadly flaws evident in the U.S. military's drone warfare program.
Really, this program doesn't work very well. It's presented generally, officially, as a program, that's incredibly precise and accurate and clean, and we go after the really bad people who are trying to do us harm, and we really don't sort of harm anyone else, and no Americans get killed, and it's all kind of very surgical and almost antiseptic. What, we've known for some time, and these documents confirm, is that actually it's not really like that. I mean, for instance, in one operation described in the documents, in this Operation Haymaker in the early stages, out of 200 people they killed, only 35 were actually the actual targets they were going after. The rest went down as EKIA, enemy killed in action. But, there's something I have to say, that the most important thing people have to understand about the drone technology is just how imprecise it is. I'll give you one rather startling fact, which I found out about, which I wrote about, which is at night, which is half the time when they're using infrared, the main infrared sensor they use, the infrared camera, if you like, has a visual acuity of 20 over 200. We all hear about 20/20 vision, which is perfect vision. Well, 20 over 200 vision is very, very poor vision. In fact, it's the legal definition of blindness for most DMVs in this country. So we're sending legally blind machines to kill people. So no wonder they get it wrong.
These new documents, as well as reporting, such as in your book, Kill Chain, talk about the unreliability of the intelligence upon which these assassinations via drone are based. Maybe you can speak about the particular mechanism of targeting an individual known as signature strikes, which is really not based on any intelligence, but is in fact based only on a person's observed movement as the drone looks down with the camera.
That's right, or your behavior. It's also called activity-based intelligence. If you sort of behave like what they think a terrorist looks like, and give off signals that they have determined indicates that you must be a terrorist, then they strike. In my book, I give an account of what was really a signature strike by the Air Force, not the CIA, in 2010. It was a small group of three vehicles carrying a bunch of poor people on their way to Kabul, going through very mountainous, remote territory in central Afghanistan. And there was a drone watching them because there was not too far away, there was an American ground force that was going to go and do a raid on a village. And it was the middle of the night. And so they saw these vehicles, and they saw that they met up, and two of the vehicles flashed their lights at a third. So they thought, this is suspicious. Then they couldn't see, this 20 over 200 business. All they could see were, through the infrared, there were sort of blobs of the people in the vehicles. But they thought they might have seen a rifle. In fact, it was probably a turkey. one of the passengers were carrying to as presents to their relatives in Kabul. Then they stopped, the vehicle stopped on a riverbank as dawn was breaking, and it looked like they were getting out to pray. And this was identified as something the Taliban do, which, of course, you know, a billion Muslims to pray as well, so it wasn't very clear. Then they were heading toward the American detachment, and that was a sign that they were, you know, going to attack this special forces unit on the ground. Then they turned away from the unit on the ground, and this was put down to a flanking maneuver. So everything was made to fit this sort of preset pattern. And finally, they attacked, you know, attacked these vehicles and killed 23 civilians, including a couple of children. So that's the problem with signature strikes. You know, you think you know, you can identify exactly what you're looking at, but you can't. I mean, things always goes wrong, which is why, you know, they killed so many civilians.
A U.S. and Italian aid worker were both killed by U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan back in January 2015, while they were being held captive by al-Qaeda in Pakistan. President Obama later came out with an apology here, which was kind of unprecedented in the history of the drone program. But is there any hope that this entire program can be reformed, restrained, restructured to make it more accountable and to make it comply with U.S. laws that govern life and death decisions?
I don't think so. How could you have a – if you decide this is what you really want to do, is to be able to assassinate people in remote parts of the world, obviously without warning, because then it wouldn't work. How can you have a trial? You know, how can you have any kind of judicial process for it? I think the whole idea of an assassination program is so misguided, you know, morally, you know, legally, and you know, militarily. You know, I mean, I've talked to enough military people who think it's a really bad idea from the point of view of fighting a war for some of the reasons that, you know, I mentioned earlier, like, you know, you end up with someone worse. So I think the whole thing should be, you know, shut down for all of the above reasons.
That was Andrew Coburn, Washington editor with Harper's Magazine and author of a new book on the U.S. drone warfare program titled Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Find links to The Intercept's Drone Papers series and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With a deterioration and lack of investment in the nation's public water supply delivery systems, more water disasters are in the headlines. From a chemical spill in a West Virginia river in January 2014 that affected 300,000 people, to the reports this month of serious contamination of the water in Flint, Michigan. More efforts are underway to privatize water that has historically been a public resource, both in the U.S. and around the world. At the same time, the growth in the sale of bottled water that consumers purchase on their own has accompanied and exacerbated the privatization trend. Corporate water privatization deals appeal to many cash-strapped cities and towns in need of costly infrastructure retrofits. But once in control of a vital public resource, corporations often use their monopoly to raise the cost of drinking water without public accountability. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mary Grant, director of the Food and Water Watch Public Water for All campaign. Here she describes her group's work, promoting the protection and affordability of the nation's water supply by fighting privatization bids and advocating for increased federal investment.
Our Public Water for All campaign, we coordinate with local communities that are working to oppose the privatization of their water system, to support community efforts that are seeking public control of their water systems from private entities. And also we support water affordability programs.
It seems we're hearing more about water problems, from the disaster in West Virginia last year that affected 300,000 consumers, to news just this week that the water in Flint, Michigan is contaminated.
Yeah, so we do see increasing instances, or at least, I don't know if it's getting worse, but we're seeing more news about it, more concern about water quality problems, and our understanding of water quality contamination is getting better, so we know the health effects of contamination. So in communities like Flint, we were proud to work with What Are You Fighting For, a local organization that was working to reconnect the city's water back to Detroit Water. When they switched from Detroit Water to Flint River Water, and the community experienced serious problems with the water quality, in particular lead poisoning in their water. And then more children are having their high levels of lead in their blood. So that's a serious issue, and it's because of the corrosion in the pipes from the switch to Flint River Water. It's more corrosive, and they didn't have the proper remediation chemicals included in the water. But we do see that this is an important issue. It remains an important issue. Since the founding of our organization, we've worked with communities working on fighting water privatization. They've reached out to us, and they need support to keep their water systems in local public hands. But what we're seeing as a growing problem is affordability. Federal funding for water and sewer systems has been decreasing. Water quality standards are getting more stringent as we understand more about the contaminants in our water. And our climate is changing. So these factors are increasing the cost of infrastructure improvements that we need in order to provide safe water. So the issue becomes, how do you pay for it with federal funding dwindling? Rates are going up in communities across the country. Water rates are regressive. So they pose a disproportionate burden on low-income households. The solution that we see is having water affordability programs to address that issue of increasing water rates and regressive water bills, to ensure that everyone has access to safe and affordable water service.
Did you say that climate change is a contributing factor in these problems?
Yeah, climate change is an issue for many communities, especially coastal communities that are seeing rising water levels. There's more flood events. There's droughts, changing climate, extremes in weather events that are affecting our water utilities that people have to plan for and make improvement projects to plan for and to protect their water supplies.
Mary Grant, I've heard it said, and, you know, this is at least partly by water companies themselves, who obviously have a vested interest, that water is the most undervalued of any of the utilities in America, and that in order to protect water quality and update infrastructure, water bills will naturally have to go up.
We think that water is priceless. It's invaluable. And so the water itself is a common resource. There is a cost to treating and distributing the water, and we want to make sure that those costs, that burden of those costs, are allocated equitably so that we're not overburdening low-income households. The intention of the affordability work that we're doing. But we also want to, ensure that all the money, all the revenue collected from water and sewer rates are going back into the system. We don't want to have profiting off of our water and sewer services. They're such essential services necessary for public health and well-being that we can't have money going out of the system.
Who exactly provides the water to communities?
I think 9 out of 10 people have water service from their local government. There are water companies, particularly in the Northeast, that these are investor-owned water companies in the Northeast that provide regional areas. So there are regional water companies, and then there are national water companies like American Water and Aqua America that serve mostly more rural communities, because there's rural communities and statewide in different states. And then we also have international, multinational water corporations like Suez and Veolia that are involved in water provision.
Isn't American Water the company responsible for the contamination disaster in West Virginia?
That was American Water. It's the largest water company in the United States. Oh, it's actually interesting. There's a local community group in West Virginia right now that are seeking local public control of their water system from American Water, in part because of the response they've seen to the water contamination that they think is inadequate, that the company responded poorly to the water contamination and didn't prepare for and plan for.
The fact that over the past 20 or 25 years, so many people have been convinced that bottled water is better, even though much of that just comes from public water supplies, there's very little oversight of the industry. How has that affected the whole situation of providing quality, affordable water to people?
That is a major concern, that there's this public perception that our tap water is unsafe, so people don't want to invest in it. And then who can afford bottled water? Maude Barlow talks about like a two-tier water system. You have people who can afford this bottled water, and then you have people who, are stuck with tap water, and if you're not having the people who can afford bottled water invest in our tap water system. Where does it leave our tap water system?
That was Mary Grant, director of the Food and Water Watch Public Water for All campaign. For more information on the group's work to ensure safe, affordable public water supplies, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thank you. The Pulitzer Prize-winning online news site InsideClimateNews.org has published a groundbreaking investigative report that revealed that ExxonMobil Corporation, the largest and most powerful oil company in the world, had known through its own cutting-edge scientific research that climate change presented a serious threat to the Earth's environment as early as the late 1970s. Despite that knowledge, Exxon spent more than two decades providing millions of dollars in funding to individuals and groups, promoting the myth that climate change was uncertain. The authors of the six-part series, titled Exxon, The Road Not Taken, using Exxon's own internal documents and citing interviews with former Exxon employees and federal officials, conclude that once the oil giant realized that government limits on the production of greenhouse gases would cut into its profits, it worked to sow doubt about the reality of global warming and lobbied to block federal and international regulations to control carbon emissions. Your reporter spoke with Jack Cushman, a reporter with Inside Climate News, who summarizes his publication's investigative report on Exxon and its possible impact at the upcoming United Nations Conference on Climate Change in Paris this December.
You know, in the way that the Pentagon Papers illuminated the Vietnam War's realities when they were finally released, we thought, let's go back and see what we can find out from the earliest days of climate research. And so we started doing the things that investigative journalists do, going to records, going to archives, reading hearings, finding people, interviewing people who were active in Exxon at the time. Exxon, of course, was the largest oil company, close to the largest oil company and one of the largest corporations in the world. And as it happened, we were kind of surprised to learn that Exxon alone among oil companies was very actively engaged in climate research in the 1970s. And we simply hadn't been aware of it, let alone of the character of the research they were doing, rigging an oil tanker to take actual ocean samples to see what the carbon flux was between the atmosphere and the ocean, and doing all kinds of imaginative research. They even proposed at one point getting 100 bottles of vintage French wine from back over the decades to see what radiocarbon isotopes of were in the wine and help determine what part of the atmospheric carbon was coming from fossil fuels and what from other sources. And it was really quite extraordinary. And in fact, we use words to describe it like extraordinary, farsighted, ambitious, rigorous, a model of corporate responsibility, even altruistic. Now Exxon says we misrepresented them, but we're puzzled to find that they would think that was a misrepresentation. So in among these documents, here's what we found. Exxon was so closely engaged in the science that it clearly understood the emerging risks of climate change. We're not saying that they knew exactly what was going to happen for the next 30 years. Nobody did, and science is always uncertain. But they knew enough to know that the Earth was warming, that climate change was probably due in part to man-made emissions of fossil fuels, their product, that this was likely enough that as the temperatures continued to rise and the signal emerged from the noise, a point which has long since passed, governments would begin to take actions, and that based on the current understanding of the science, those actions would probably mean cutting down on the use of fossil fuels, hence an existential risk to Exxon. And this was spelled out in many ways, and in documents we went through hundreds of documents, we went through a lot of interviews, we went through other sources that are already on the record, and this was a little examined time, and we wanted to examine Exxon's subsequent record of influencing climate policy by muddying the science in the light of what they knew in the early days. And so as we looked at these documents, we found a very early briefing to the board, which explored all the uncertainties involved in the emergent state of climate change as of 1977, and which presented the conclusion. And it was in a long document, but as journalists, you pick up a document and you look for the summary. And so this document was a summary, an extensive summary of the, of a presentation to top management by a senior scientist. And the summary he wrote down in order to be able to share this much more broadly within the corporation. And it was, you know, a fairly detailed document of many pages. So under the word summary, that document presented its conclusion, and it said, in the first place, there's general scientific agreement that the most likely manner in which mankind is influencing the global climate is through carbon dioxide release from the burning of fossil fuels. And to us, that was a revelation. That was news. And so we took it from there, and what you have now is a six-part series of tens of thousands of words that goes into really extraordinary detail about Exxon's earliest engagement with climate science, and then a discussion of what's much better known, their decades of undermining the science.
What effect do you think is likely of your investigation on ExxonMobil, what they knew and what they didn't know about climate change? What effect do you think that'll have on the important meeting that's going to be taking place in Paris, France, at the UN Climate Summit this December?
Well, I think that in terms of the climate science, you know, the horse has gone from the barn at this point. This year, once again, is the warmest year ever recorded. So I don't think Exxon really has much chance of influencing the outcome of these negotiations. The rest of the world's oil companies, by and large, are going to the negotiators and saying, we need certainty and we need an approach that gets us to the international targets. And Exxon and a handful of other mostly American oil companies are outside that group, but I think the tide is moving against them.
That was Jack Cushman, a reporter with InsideClimateNews.org. Find links to the group's six-part series titled Exxon, the Road Not Taken, and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.